if you put 1 ampere into a 1 farad capacitor and you do it for 1 complete second, it will experience a change in voltage across the plates of the capacitor of 1 volt. So you could say 1 farad equals 1 volt ampere per second. And that's the definition of a farad, but that's a very big capacitor. So in the United States, for a lot of years, the most popular value is a microfarad, 1/1,000,000 of a farad. And for the extremely small capacitors, we use picofarad, or in the old days, used to be called microfarad, which is 1/1,000,000 of a farad. 1,000,000 is a 10^-6 number, so a picofarad is 10^-12. Well, the Europeans like the intermediate values of 10^-9, a nanofarad. So they use the word nanofarad to talk about a capacitor that's bigger than 1,000 picofarad, but smaller than 0.001 microfarad. They use the word nanofarad. And for them, it's a very convenient value. The United States, until recently, we almost never used nanofarads on the marking of our components or on our schematic diagrams. But in the modern day world, you have to learn these exponents of kilo is 10^3, milli is 10^-3, micro is 10^-6, nano is 10^-9, pico is 10^-12. So a picofarad is 10^-12 farads. And to go from pico to nano, you move the decimal point.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To move from picofarads to nanofarads, you move the decimal point 3 places to the left. To go from nanofarads to microfarads, you move it 3 more places to the left. So in the American marking system, to go from picofarad to microfarad, you move the decimal place 6 places. But the Europeans didn't like doing that, so they started using nanofarad. A very reasonable unit, just that it wasn't popular in the United States. Well, now that more and more of our components are being outsourced in their manufacture, the majority of our electronics these days is being built in Southeast Asia because the labor rates are so much cheaper, and therefore we're starting to become more and more metric and more European oriented, if you know what I mean. So that's part of what's going on. Anything you can do to aim a little more antenna or go to a little higher power would help. I'm hearing some static on my signal in the background, even though I'm in the desirable portion of the antenna pattern. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn. And by the way, I mailed you a couple of articles on the subject of power factors that I thought were kind of cute. Wanted to get a chance to see those. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, actually, they're very good. I was hoping to get back to you, but unfortunately, my schedule of work has been really crazy. But just a little update about, you know, some of the markings on components that, you know, talking about nanofarads with the Europeans, that has really started to go away about a little more than 10 years ago. That's actually more than that. Basically, what's happened was the IEC, which governs a lot of the, I shouldn't say govern, it's basically their standards, for most of the European community, have gone basically to the picofarad standard for capacitors, and basically following very, very close along the same lines as the United States and the Far East. So everybody's basically using the marking standard for IEC 6062, and I believe now it's up to the 5th edition. And just as you were saying before, you know, using the 3-digit system for capacitors and being based on picofarads is right on the money. And you'll also find the P in between if they can't use the 3-digit system because you're down to single digits. So instead of saying, you know, you can't put 1/8 on a device because then it would be 18. So in order to split the decimal point, you have to put a P in between to identify the decimal point on the capacitor. That's in the IEC 6062, or 600062. And the same thing with the resistors, you know, like... when you're using the down to 5% accuracy, they also use the 3-digit positioning, where the third digit is really the number of zeros at the end that you add on. And, of course, it's still the same value if you want to go to higher position, except they use four digits across, not to confuse anybody inside there. But basically now that has become a worldwide standard. Most everybody's following the IEC today in almost all new equipment. But if, like you're saying, older European equipment, you might still find nanofarads floating around someplace.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If I was using a precision 5% or 1% resistor, and I wanted to represent the resistance with three significant figures as opposed to the two that normally used, and also indicate the number of zeros afterwards, a resistor of 22.3 kiloohms, I think, would be represented as 22K3. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if that's close to being correct, Eric. I mean, Mel. Here we go. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, there wouldn't be a K in there. Basically, what would happen is you'd have your, you would wind up with a fourth digit. So basically what would happen is, like, you'd have, if you wanted to show one, in other words, if you went from 5% to like 10, 20%, 10%, 5%, we'll use the three-digit system. So you have basically two digits, and then the third one is zero. So two are significant, one is the zero multiplier at the end. If you have 1% or better, you have to go to four digits. So basically you have three significant digits, and then the last one would be the zero, if you follow what I'm saying there. The only time you really ever see the R is, like, in resistors, is to show, because you're not going to be having the extra significant digits doesn't mean anything with very, very low ohms values or low capacitance values. So basically you'll just have the point, and then it would have the extra significant digit would have to be after the decimal point, if you follow what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so in the example I just gave then, a 1% resistor of 22,000 ohms, 22.3 thousand ohms would be, in the four-digit system, 2232. I'll say that again, 2232. 223 is the three first significant digits, and then the two for the fourth place is telling you add two more zeros. 22300 would be 22.3 kiloohms of resistance. I think I've got that one right this time, Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Right on the money, Dick. And as I said there again, if it was a low value where you needed decimal points, then those significant digits would have to be after the R or after the P, if you follow what I'm saying. But that's exactly it, KC2QIQ.
So in the precision 1% resistor, 22.3 ohms would then be represented as 22R3, would be 22.3 ohms of resistance. Is that approximately right, Glenn? Go ahead.
You got it right on the money.
Now, I think the chances of these guys that are taking apart components finding 1% components where they're using the four cipher marking system, I think it's a bit rare. I think 98% of the time they're going to be running into three cipher markings, and therefore a 223 would be a 22 and three more zeros. That would be a 22K resistor. And so when it comes to these fractional value capacitors, apparently the Europeans are using the P for the decimal place, or the Orient is using a P, and the Europeans are using the R, but...
So, Dick, everybody's using the P for the capacitors.
Oh, really? So the R is not being used at all anymore. How about that? So back to you, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, raise the power up to 55 watts. A little better copy now, over.
Tremendous improvement. Please proceed.
Okay, because usually the 20 watts or 10 or 15 watts position is usually enough, so I went up all the way. Yeah, this is it. You're finding old goodies, as they say, and yeah, sure, they are a treasure chest of wonderful little components to play with. Yeah, we've lost anyhow. We've lost the group that they have to usually check out, go to bed by 10 o'clock. So I just want to make them aware. All right, I'll answer some of the questions. I know I'm going to get questions about these markings and all on the stuff and all and everything, but let them put them aside, and if there's ones that are marked that they don't quite understand, I will, of course, help them with it. We won't get into filters because, you know, you find on the boards a lot of capacitors. We'll get other assessments. We'll do that next week. Like, see, a lot of the boards do contain things like tantalum capacitors. They do stick those little drops, those little blue drops on the board, these little filters, tantalum filter capacitors. So we'll discuss all that. We'll leave it go at this because I know I'll have to answer some questions. Okay. Go ahead with the tech test. This is KC2KEY.
KC2QIQ with one more continent.
Okay, that was Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Mel, just a quick thing, too, especially for young people just learning the markings and, you know, where to get a hold of them. In other words, where is it available? There's a thing called the IEC web store, and you can get a copy of the standard, the IEC standard, and it's 60062. As I said, right now it's up to 5th edition. You can get a copy of it and print it out, and it will explain how all the capacitors are marked, all the resistors are marked, all the different types, because now it's basically, it's a worldwide standard. So it's a very, very valuable thing to have, especially when you're trying to identify components that you're really not sure of. I think it's a very, very valuable thing to have, even if just maybe one person buys it and makes a few copies for a few others. Very, very valuable thing to have around. KC2QIQ.
WX Glenn for a capacitor question.
Paul recognized, but first, Glenn, IEC, most likely that stands for International Electronic Component, so that's the standard. And if a person Googles the word IEC Web Store, he'll be able to find this 60062 document, which I think you're saying is the standard. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes. Actually, IEC, what it stands for, is it's the International Electrotechnical Commission. And basically, right now, the standard is the IEC 60062. Right now, it's 5th edition. Very, very valuable thing to have. You can find it on the web. As I said, right now, there's a place called the IEC Web Store. And as a matter of fact, for, you know, marking codes for resistors and capacitors, that's that particular standard. But, I mean, they've got standards for just about everything. They've got standards for how PC boards are supposed to be marked, labeled, how to identify, you know. Needless to say, my office is stacked with all these standards, Nick, you can imagine. So, but they are very, very valuable standards to have. I mean, obviously, the ones that you memorize are the ones that you use all the time, but the ones that, there are some obscure ones, and especially if you're hunting through equipment and you find something that just looks odd, they're great things to have around because it can really answer a lot of very, very strange questions.
I can just imagine your office with the bookshelf filled up with all these books, with all these standards. I used to do something fairly similar to that at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and from time to time they would move my office from point A to point B, and my superiors would complain about the fact that I have so many books on so many bookshelves. Can't I get rid of all that stuff? Why do you store so much junk? To which I would try to convince them that engineering requires a database. And pretty soon the day came when some of those supervisors told me, hey, Dick, I need the standard so-and-so. Do you have a copy of that? To which I would say, yes, but don't you realize you're asking for forbidden fruit? You're asking me to hand you a copy of the thing that you told me to throw out. I get a very funny look on their face. I said, you may think that engineers work in a vacuum. All engineers require a database. We're going to be going pretty soon over to Lou, NY2H. But before we do, Paul had a question. WS2N on capacitors? Go right ahead, Paul. And by the way, also tell us whether or not we should set aside some time for finding out what's going on in space. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. No, Dick, I haven't had much time lately to get involved with following what's going on lately. I know there's a private launch recently, but what we'll do in the future is follow these robotic missions. I think they'll be very interesting. Manned missions will be coming, but I think that will be coming with the
looking at quicken up right now. It seems like a very long way off before they really do that outside of these suborbital flights that are planned next year. Dick, yeah, I had a question about the capacitors. Some of them, I take things off the boards all the time, and like what Mel always suggested, they'll resist it. But some of these boards I've come across are yellow, rectangular box shaped, soldered to the PC board. Now, I was just wondering, why do they use the boxy shaped capacitors? I mean, when I first saw them, I thought they were relays. I thought they were sealed relays. Because in fact, one of them had like a K on it. I found out that was, standard for three zeros. But I was thinking, oh, K, like a K on a diagram with, K1, K2. That they would normally be relays. So I just wonder why they choose that if you were an engineer. Why would you pick these instead of a different type of capacitor? What's the benefit of these rectangular, three-dimensional rectangular yellow ones? In the case I saw yellow boxes for capacitors back in there.
Yeah, in modern-day circuitry, the size of the component and the amount of real estate required on the printed circuit board is really at a premium. You take a modern-day cell phone that somebody has thrown away, and if they really threw it away, and they're not going to be trading it in. And if you take the time to take it apart and look at it under a microscope for a good large magnifying glass, you'll be amazed the technology you're looking at. Quite often you're looking at a printed circuit board that doesn't have just a front face and a back face. In many cases, it has 14 individual layers when you look at the edge of the PC board. And each one of those layers has wiring between the individual leads of all the components that are up on the upper surface and the lower surface. And they're plated through holes, making contacts in specific areas between the layers. The most modern, the most popular type of capacitor, let me drop this. When it comes to small filter capacitors and small coupling capacitors, in the few microfarad region and below, these rectangular yellow packages that are in many cases numbers like a 603, 60 thousandths of an inch long, 30 thousandths of an inch wide, and a little bit less than that high. Those are tantalum capacitors. The actual contacts are on the opposite end of the capacitor. They get soldered down to the board. In the case of polarized capacitors, there's a specific marking, a ring on one side, letting you know that that's the cathode end, that's the one where you put the negative voltage in many cases. So it's just a very popular size of extremely compact tantalum capacitor. And if somebody installs that capacitor on the printed circuit board upside down so that the reverse voltage is on that polarized capacitor, in many cases it's only a period of time before the capacitor starts drawing high current, your reverse electroplating, what's going on with the individual plates inside, pretty soon it starts drawing very high current and literally explodes on location. It's not a very destructive explosion, but there's all kinds of fancy fluids in there that get sprayed onto your printed circuit board, and you don't want to have your eye real close to it when it happens. So it's a very popular kind of tantalum surface mount capacitor that I believe you're describing nowadays, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2YDT,
what's your question? Okay, Dick, thank you. Okay, basically, it's a mechanical, like you said, a real estate problem. Interesting. Thank you, Dick.
Okay, KC2, Yankee Delta Tango is what it sounds like. If your question is on this subject right now, go right ahead with your question and tell us your name, sir.
That's a negative. It's on a different subject. Probably a very quick answer, but I'm going to have to drop out in 15 minutes max. I've got to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning for work tomorrow.
Yeah, sorry to say, We've got a list of people who have already signed in, and we got to go down that list in the right order, so we might not get to you. But where you signed in today and we don't get to you, you'll be number one on the runway next week when you come back. The next person who was on our list with a question was Lou, NY2H. Lou, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. Go right ahead with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very fine. Good evening, everybody. I was at the HamFest today. Had the distinct pleasure of meeting Mel. And that was nice. We had a chat. I picked up a mobile antenna, a dual-band 2-meter 440 antenna, about a 36-inch in length, and I have a mag mount. My question has to do with the mounting of the mag mount or location of it. I know we decided that mag mounts were fine in terms of the capacitive, coupling. In my vehicle, I have a sunroof, and that sunroof obviously breaks up the ground plane or the counterpoise. So I was wondering if there's a better placement than the center of the roof, and also as a secondary, if there would be any advantage to putting in any kind of, like, say, foil or anything underneath that sunroof, underneath the glass, which may or may not be bonded to the rest of the sheet metal. So that's it. Fairly simple question, and just wondering what your thoughts might be on that, Dick. NY2H.
On a quick break, Lou, the sunroof goes from a little bit beyond, a little bit rearward of the forward piece of glass, your windshield, usually covers about half the roof, and then there's a great big chunk of metal between the rear portion of the sunroof and the rear window. There's still quite a bit of metal left in the car. Is that true in your case, or is all of your roof of the car something like fiberglass? Is there some remaining metal to your roof, Lou? Go ahead.
Affirmative, Dick. There is. The sunroof goes beyond the front seats, the back ends of the front seats, but the passenger compartment in the back mostly would be covered by sheet metal. It does pitch down a bit. Now, I think that this antenna, I think it has a tilt-over capacity, so I may be able to actually adjust for that if I do move it back there. Before this, I had a 19-inch, and it did not adjust, and I sometimes put it back there, and it would not be vertical anymore. It would kind of tilt towards the rear.
Okay, I've got some pretty good news for you. If you mount your mag mount on the metal portion of the roof, behind the sunroof, but in forward of the rear window, you're going to get 98% of the performance you would have if there was no sunroof at all. If you think about it, you realize that the way your roof of your car is made, around the perimeter of that sunroof, you've got metallic surface. Your eye, which is operating at a ridiculously high frequency, sees all the fine details of the hole in the roof where the glass is mounted for the sunroof itself. Because your car does not have a moonroof, that's the one that's a sunroof over the rear passenger seats, and some of the recreation vehicles have a moonroof, you don't have that. Mounting it right there, you're going to get the majority of the performance you would get is if your whole roof was metallic. That hole that your eye sees for sunroof is not there radio-wise most of the way. By that I mean, if I was trying to build a piece of waveguide to send a signal at 146 megacycles down it, let me drop. The waveguide would have to be a bare minimum of 3 feet wide. Is that sunroof 3 feet wide? I don't think so, but with your ruler you'll find out. Let's see, 2 meters would be, stand by now, that would be exactly 150 megacycles. You're down at 146. probably something like 3.2 meters. In order to have the signal propagate into that hole, as if that hole was a piece of waveguide, there'd have to be a minimum dimension across the two sides, the starboard side and the port side of the car. That minimum dimension across the width of your car would have to be something like 3.2 meters in order for the signal to go in there. Therefore, because of the metallic rim around your sunroof, I think you're going to be very pleasantly surprised that you're going to get essentially the same performance. So I would mount the mag mount right where you're talking about mounting it. The fact that the roof slants a little bit and the fact that the whip is going to be tilted a little bit is an extremely minor factor. Let me drop. If you have a tiltable mechanism on your mag mount and you can correct that and it would make you feel happier, go ahead and do it. But if you ran a test with the mag mount mounted to your metal that's on your roof, which has got a slight slant to it, which means now the antenna is not exactly perpendicular to the ground, maybe it's tilted 10 or 15 degrees to the ground, the signal that falls off because of that tilt to somebody that's broadside, forward and reverse propagation is going to be normal. Broadside, the person is not going to get a purely vertical signal. He's going to get a slight slant in polarization by that 10 or 15 degree angle of your tilt. And that signal falls off as the cosine of that angle. Well, the cosine of 0 degrees, correction, 90 degrees, if it was perfectly perpendicular to the ground, that would be a 90 degree angle to the ground. A cosine of 90 degrees is 1. If I took the cosine of 15 degrees off of that, which I'm about to do, cosine of 75 degrees, you're going to find out that it's a very little difference. I just did it, and I did it wrong. Try that again. Cosine of 75 degrees. I said cosine, I should be saying sine. Here we go. Cosine of 75 degrees is 0.966. 0.966, if I take the log of that and multiply it by 20, because it's a voltage phenomena, you're losing less than 3/10 of 1 decibel because of the tilt, which is 1/20 of an S unit on a well-calibrated receiver. As you can see, it's a very minor factor. When you start tilting the antenna from being straight up for vertical polarization, until you get to a 45-degree angle of tilt, very little happens, Lou.
So you'll repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I decided to wait to make sure the machine resets, and I hope we haven't dropped out the Eastern machine, which is the way you're coming in, Lou. And I think you also have the ability to flip back and forth between East and West. So don't worry about the tilt. Don't worry about the hole in the roof until it's way beyond 3.2 meters of hole on that dimension across. And even then, you'd have to be launching the signal parallel to the hole, not perpendicular to the hole. That hole is 98% not there, if you know what I mean. It should work like a charm. You could later on do a quick experiment, put your mag mount on the rear deck of the car or on the front hood of the car, just as an experiment. And I think when you do that experiment by going into a parking lot and doing circles and listening to signal strength, I think you're going to find out that altitude counts a lot more than where you mount it on the car. I'm reasonably sure that the roof of the car is the highest part you've got. There's a lot of metal there. There's a metal rim around that sunroof. I predict it's going to work like a charm. Go for it. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet. Hope we didn't drop you out.
No, not at all. I'm listening on the Western. I transmit on the Eastern, and I listen on the Western. And it seems to work out best for me that way. And, okay, yeah, so the aperture is going to be, of course, relatively larger on when I go up to the UHF, when I go up to 440, but it sounds like it still will not be critical. And just to be sure, I think what you're saying is where the sheet metal begins at the, you know, aft of the sunroof, go halfway between that and where it ends. center of the existing panel. I think that's what you're saying. But sounds good. Now, I asked a general question, and you came back with very, very specific analytical information. And that's why we love you, Dick. Thank you very much, NY2H.
And KC2QIQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've been using Magna. Magna's almost all the time. I very, very rarely, especially for VHF and UHF, use any kind of other harder mounts. And one of the things I found very early on is that the ground plane on the roof is more sensitive with quarter wave antennas, because then you're going to have the counterpoise fully using the roof to get the second half of the waveform in resonance. But the what I found is that with the half wave and the 5/8 wave antennas in the mag mounts, they seem to get the best performance, because at half wave you have very, very little currents going into the roof at all, and 5/8 wave just a mild amount. So the half wave, 2 meter, 5/8 wave, 440 dual band antennas on the mag mount seem to have very, very good performance. And the amount of a little bit of capacitance that has to be loaded on the mag mount by attaching it to the roof is actually pretty minuscule. So like Dick is saying, mounting that antenna as high as you can on the car is going to give you your best performance, and the counterpoise of the roof with half wave and 5/8 wave antennas in mag mount isn't going to be that significant. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very glad Glenn brought up that extra point. And we're talking about electronic half wave now, Lou. If you decide to, at a later time, choose a mag mount antenna, which is advertised as an electronic half wave, that means either the whip is longer and there's the right kind of a loading coil at the bottom and a maintenance matching network built into that mag assembly, which you may not know about, but it's got to be there, or if it's got a squiggly coil in the middle of its whip, as long as the radiating structure is electronically a half wave, or 5/8 wave comes close, you get about three advantages. Number one, the antenna tends to be a little bit longer. Number two, the phase center is a little bit higher above the ground. Number three, it launches almost zero current into the roof of the car. And therefore, in the case of a half wave mag mount antenna, which is a little bit of a conflict here about what I'm about to say, I am almost positive that a half-wave mag-mount antenna would give you 95% of the same performance if the whole darn car was fiberglass. That's something really important to remember. If you happen to have a fiberglass or a mostly fiberglass car, and you want to put a mag-mount or something equivalent to it, and if you can be smart enough to buy, an antenna that is really, truly an electronic half-wave radiator, you'll pick up a huge advantage, because almost no current flows into the counterpoise, into the ground plane. And you can get away with murder with that. You'd be amazed how many guys have operated the 20-meter handband from the balcony of their apartment at the 20th floor of an apartment building and used a helical-wound half-wave radiating section that's mounted to the metal railing, that's the guardrail, of the balcony of their apartment. And that tiny little piece of metal, wavelength-wise, at the 20-meter handband, gave them a beautiful counterpoise, as long as the radiator was a half-wave. Very little current got launched into it. And they got out like a banshee and did a whole lot of DX work. You're also a little bit concerned about the size of the hole in your sunroof when you're operating in the 450 band. Yes, your counterpoise is going to be a little bit more complicated in its structure when you're on the 450 band. You're still going to work like a charm as long as it's high enough above the ground and mounted to your automobile. Whether you mount the mag mount at the forward edge or the rearward edge of your remaining metal, that's a minor experiment you can try. I think the difference is going to be awfully small. Center, forward edge, rear edge, I'm not sure which will work best, but I think the difference is very small, and you will get a little more performance if on either of those bands you go to a half-wave radiating section. Now, Lou, NY2H, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Very fine, very fine. Thank you so much, and let me just say that the TechNet tonight has been very interesting from Chebyshev to Bessel and beyond. And I think the thing that remains with me is conservation of misery. Conservation of misery. Love the phrase. I'm gonna use that. Thank you, Dick, and good night.
Yeah, I think I used the word conservation of misery last week. I don't think I used it this week. Is that true, Lou?
Well, if in a couple of days you go to .atv there or, you know, amateur radio, that you'll hear you did use it because I heard it earlier today, you know, on the net. But that's fine. I like it.
Yeah. You'd be amazed how many places in life the decision you have to make represents a number of compromises. And when you look at the big picture, there is to some degree conservation of misery. Mother Nature behaves like that. The next guy who's going to be on the list is Matt, I think it was. Yes, KC2 Yankee Delta Tango. Matt, go right ahead with your question if you're still with us. KC2 IDT, hope we didn't put you to sleep. K2 RIW in the TechNet. Maybe Matt's not there right now. Mel, you did say you wanted to tell us a couple of words about what it was like at the flea market today. Sorry to say I didn't get a chance to go. So, what did you see? How much did you spend? Who did you talk to? What was it like? K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech desk.
Okay, this is K2KEY again. Well, it was the weather was reasonable. You know, they threatened showers, thunder showers and all, but they didn't show up, so I think it may have been responsible. I may be wrong, but I didn't see the turnout that we've had in the past. Seems to be a little bit on the quiet side. Not as many people selling things. A lot of real odds and ends. Strange odds and ends that, you know, you don't expect to see at Ham Fest, such as one guy had an old violin to sell, they had an old guitar they were selling, and another guy had some stereo equipment, regular FM stereo phonographs and things of that sort, and a lot of old, just regular radios, you know, cable radios, things of that sort, sort of a lot of that. And some surplus, a lot of it very beat up, very stripped, and all kinds of things. And one guy had some interesting things, had a truckload of all kinds of antenna stuff. towers, sections of Roan Tower. And let me let it drop. And parts of antennas. I don't know where he got all kinds of elements. And could have had a fairly reasonable. You want to have a lot of money for it. Boy, I'll tell you, if you want to fill the beam, and you had to go out and buy that kind of a amount of aluminum. But once I put up the power, he had enough power sections of the run 20-foot, I think it was 20-foot sections, it looked like. He had enough there to put up a tower of quite a bit of height. And it was in a, you know, good-sized truck. So, things like that. So, it was for somebody that was looking for things, unusual things. There was a lot of good buys. I personally, it was one or two things I always look for, but didn't see any of that stuff at all. What I've been interested in, but my friend had been along and found something. We had mentioned, you know, guying because he has a vertical. That's what I'll tell you about later. He has one of these verticals, and it suffices this situation. And it needs the guying, this non-metallic guy wire. So let me let it drop. The non-metallic guy that they sell, you know, that Dacron, that black Dacron, they had it. It was a fairly reasonable price. He got 150 feet of it, a roll of it, 150 feet, 3/8 diameter, for about $20 some odd. So that was a good buy. And the guy had a lot of that type of stuff there, you know, for putting antennas up, U-clamps that was laying there, and stuff like that. And I gotta say, if you're in the market for materials, I'm sure it could save itself a heck of a lot of money, but just look what the aluminum pipe now to put a heat together has gone per foot. It's outrageous. So if you take cars written by elements, handsets like that, you can, you know, readopt them for whatever you want to do. I mean, these were elements, a lot of them with coils on them and all kinds of things, mountings, you know, support. There was a couple of, he had some beams laying there that were Mosley beams with that center plate, which would cost you a big chunk of money now. Six clamp horizontal and six clamp vertical on this plate. It's real, you know, good piece of material. And, I mean, let it drop. You know, good piece of material, aluminum, it's alloyed aluminum, and, you know, buy a thing like that. If you bought just a piece of material like that, drilled it out, and looked for those stainless steel 3/8 clamps, U-clamps and all, you know, that could cost you a good chunk of money, so. Yeah, you could pick that stuff up there, at a ham fest like that. And then he had rotors, had quite a number of, like, ham M rotors. He says they think they work. They may not work, but, you know, they're all repairable. You can take those rotors easily apart and get all the parts that are available. So, you know, they didn't sell much. I don't think the sales were quite there. He's talking with Andy, and it seems to be somewhat quiet. He didn't seem to be very busy checking out equipment. But, all right, we met a lot of people there, and nice to have them, say, an eyeball with them. Dick, sorry you couldn't make it. Go ahead.
Very fine, Bill. That was a very good price you got for 3/8 black Dacron rope, which really means it's ultraviolet protected, that may survive out in the weather for a long number of years. You said that the tower sections and or the aluminum tubing, some of it was 20 feet long. Were those tower sections 20 feet long? If so, were they Roan tower sections, or was it aluminum tubing that was 20 feet long? Back to you, Mel.
Well, the Roan tower sections, this was a commercial radio tower somewhere, I think it looks like he took down. This is the heavy Roan, what is it, the 20, I believe it's the heaviest Roan tower section. They make, what do they call that, Schedule 25, I think, over?
The typical ham tower was Roan 25. The next size up was Roan 45. That's the one that has 18 inches on a side triangle. The next size up from that is Roan 55, again 18 inches on the side, but a larger diameter tubing. And the next size above that is Roan 65, which I believe is 24 inches on a side. So that's the way the Roan numbers work. The Roan number in general indicates size of the triangle, and then when you dig a little bit deeper, it's the thickness of the wall of the vertical pieces of tubing. And the biggest stuff they make was Roan 85, which is 43 inches on a face. So if you could make a rough guess as to how wide was the triangle of the cross-section of the Roan tower sections, and were they 20 feet long? Back to you, Mel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB.
Oh, no, I don't. It could have been 12-inch, maybe. He had, I could say, a truckload of it, an awful lot of sections in there. I really, you know, the aluminum elements that he had, the, you know, lengths of aluminum, they were, oh, easily, many pieces were 20, 30 feet long element pieces. You know, these were good sections of elements. I asked him, he said most of it was Mosley material. That's because I sort of recognized it. But Mosley did build a lot of good antenna systems, especially, you know, they produce a lot for the government. So they use some good quality elements and some, you know, real big, full-size HF antennas, Dick, over.
Mr. WGB, give us your full call and your name. Sounds like you've got some information. Go ahead.
No, just checking to make sure you didn't forget me, KC2WGB, John.
And I did forget you, John, and I'm going to come back to you right now. In fact, go right ahead, John, KC2WGB. You got it.
Let Mel finish. No problem. I got time.
Any further words, Mel?
No, it's just that it's enjoyable, you know, to see people that we talk to and have some nice discussions. So it was very pleasant. And the weather, I could say, was mostly cooperative. And, you know, I get a kick out, of course, you know, looking at a lot of people say, what are you looking at? All I'm fascinated, as they say, by junk. And there was plenty of it there, so I had enjoyed looking at stuff from the past, Vic, over.
Very fine. Okay, John, you're next. And what are the guys in Staten Island doing? Looks to me like you're within line of sight of the Verrazano Bridge when I look at the map of where you live. KC2 WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening, Dick, Mel, everybody on the net. I have a little scenario I'd like to propose to you, a real quick one, and I'd like to ask you a question after that. Let me just make sure I have it. Okay, recently I've just purchased a quad band Diamond HF tunable radial antenna. It'll be mounted approximately 25 feet in the air, which I will not be able to reach it to tune it. I'm going to attempt to tune it on the ground on a 10-foot mast, if that's the proper thing to do, with my little MFJ tuner and the cable that will actually be used with it, which is LMR 475 feet. Now, I'd like to try that, doing that in my driveway. I have nothing. I have at least 30 to 40 foot azimuth radius around it where there's nothing, no fences or anything. And I would like to know, my question is there a sequence to tuning, high to low? Do I vacillate between them, or do I do low to high? That's my question, Dick. I need your help.
And when you say quad band, does that mean 10, 15, 20, and maybe the walk bands in between? Is that what you're saying? John, go ahead.
6 to 40.
Whoa. 6 to 40. That's more than quad band. Wow. Mel, have the guys in the Kings County Radio Club used that Diamond quad band antenna? And what procedure did they use for tuning it? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. We're going to get to that a little later. If you remember, last week we were discussing some of these verticals that we saw in a magazine. Well, one young guy has one here in Brooklyn. He has a particular situation where, well, he's got to keep, as they say, the peace. And he wants to get on HF. And he asked me, he says, you know, the antenna, basically, it comes apart so easy. I mean, you know, it's just like basically an antenna you can use for portable operation. It does extend up about 20 some odd feet in height. And so we put it up here on the deck here, which says, let me let it drop. Drive the installation I did. I have a patio deck. And it's about a patio deck that gets us 15 feet above ground level. It's on the second floor. And I was able to provide them with a mast up there. Clamped it up. Like I say, it went together so goddamn quick. And just put a piece of coax, short piece of coax on. And connected it up to my portable receiver. And we used as a comparison, basically. I brought out another cable there, right from tension cable that I have, in case I ever want to, you know, do any operating from that patio deck with one of my small radios that I can attach it to any of my antennas. So I basically we're looking at receiving the best place for receivers on 10 meters or 30 meters because, first of all, I got the WWB was coming in very good. It was 5920 over WWB at 10.0000, of course. And then there's a power pipe station that operates at 10.100, right at the bottom of the 30-ounce radio band. So we made measurements, you know, we're listening to both of them on both my, I have a dipole for 30 meters, that's up about 50 meters. And we decided to, you know, I want won't bother so much about transmitting. Let's just see how it does on receiving. And using good old dipole standards, we seem to have fairly good results with that 30-meter dipole. So we were listening to it, and they have a... sideband CPU and all. And so we use that for basically receiving. It's got LED type of F meter. But something very interesting about these sticks. He let it go with that. Just, you know what. Let me, I think, pause at this point if you have any questions that before I get into the nitty gritty. Over.
Yeah, I think John is asking about this particular antenna. I'm looking at the Diamond antenna now, which is called Quad Band FM and mobile antenna. That must not be the right one. This one covers 70 centimeters down to 10 meters. That's not the right one, I don't think. The CR8900A. His main question is when he lines it up in his backyard with his LMR 475 feet of it. I think he said he's going to be putting it on a 10-foot mast. And tuning it up in the air is very difficult to him. He's going to be lining it up on the ground. I think his main question is, if I understand correctly, when he lines it up close to the ground, like with a small piece of tubing that he can get to with a stepladder, and then when he lines it up to the full altitude, is there going to be a significant difference? That's what I think John's question is. I'm going to pass it back to John to make sure I haven't misunderstood it. And if I haven't misunderstood his question, what John is concerned about, let me drop it.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay. We'll be going over to Glenn. Depending on the design of the antenna, if it launches a substantial amount of current into the mounting structure, then in some cases the length of the mounting structure makes a difference in the tuning. I wonder if you're familiar with this particular antenna that John's talking about, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, not necessarily this particular antenna, but just the mounting verticals above the ground level. In other words, getting them up off the ground and mounting them up on house structure. There's a couple of pointers I'd like to point out. One is that if you're going to mount it with a mast, try to use the one that you're going to test with on the ground at ground level. Is test with the mast that's probably going to be used in the final location, wherever it's going to be mounted. Try to use something that looks as close to that as possible. Let me let this drop for a second. Then what I would do is adjust the antenna when it's finally assembled on this mast to basically all the centered manufactured recommendation settings. Usually they come with, in the directions, the lengths that are set up for the parts of the bands that you want, each segment that you want to use and you want to favor. Set them up initially, take a measurement of the antenna, and see how close all the VSWR is in those bands if it's matching with the mast length that you're using. Then what I would do is try to make some minor adjustments, you know, lengthen things, shorten things up a little bit, just to see which direction things move. Then mount the, then put everything back again to the original manufacturer's suggestions, put it back up on the roof, mount it down, measure it again. If that, usually everything does fall into place, but sometimes, at least this way, after making the measurements in the driveway, you'll have a better feeling for which elements you may have to move if you have to take it down and make a readjustment. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very fine, Glenn. Thank you for that information. I think I found the antenna that John's talking about. Charlie Papa 725 Hotel Quad Band Trap Vertical Antenna, which operates 40 meters to 6 meters inclusive. 6 meters, 10 meters, 15 meters, 40 meters. And it's 11.8 feet tall, radial 71 inches long. I see it has radials at the bottom and also some radios in the middle. And I like Glenn's suggestion. The metal pipe that it's going to be on makes some difference if it's going on to a non-conducting structure. In other words, if you're going to be mounting it on the chimney of a house, then testing it with the right length of pipe on the ground and then just moving that piece of pipe on top of the house should give you very close correlation. John's other question was, should he tune 6 meters first or 40 meters first? I see that they claim that on 6 meters it is 500 kc wide, 10 meters 600 kc wide, 15 meters 300 kc wide, but 40 meters 45 kc. It looks to me like the critical tuning is the 40 meter tuning. That's the one that really counts because it's the most narrow band portion of the band. And those probably are the places where it is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio apart. I'm beginning to think the only real tuning that's going to be required is on 40 meters because of the bandwidth you've got down there. And if that metal pipe is just being moved to a chimney or the top of the roof, you should get close correlation. If the metal pipe is then going to be mounted on top of a metal tower, it could get a little bit of a change, and we'll explain that a little bit on the next transmission. Let's see if I've made some of the right guesses as to which antenna you're talking about, John. KC2, WGH, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, you have, Dick. You've got it exactly right. That's the antenna, and the only problem is the mast that I'm using is going to be 40 at least. I have 9 antennas altogether. I cannot work with it on the ground. That's why I must use a small mast. Try to tune it that way. I understand exactly what Glenn is saying. I could do it if I could get my bucket truck into the area, but I can't do that. So I will tune from 40 down then and do that and maybe go back and double check. Is there any type of interrelationship between the tuning that you are aware of, or maybe Mel or Glenn?
Yeah, where if I understand you correctly, there's going to be a change in the length of pipe the antenna is mounted on when you're tuning it on the ground versus the real location. And because 40 meters is what? 125, 130 feet wave length. That pipe that it's mounted on, because the antenna itself is only how many feet long? 11.8 feet. It is an electrically shortened antenna, probably with a loading coil mechanism. Therefore, I'm reasonably sure it's going to be launching a substantial amount of current into the mounting structure. Therefore, the length of the mounting structure is, I'm pretty sure, going to affect the tuning. And where you're only going to be getting 40, or what was the number now, 25 kc? 45 kc of bandwidth. I'm a little bit worried that there's going to be some change in tuning. It's not a showstopper. If at worst you tune it to your favorite frequency on 40 meters and you miss that frequency up in the air, that's not a showstopper because even if the antenna is giving you, let me pick a number out of the air, a wild number like 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. Assume you wanted to tune it to the 7.2 megacycle region and it fell at 7.1. And at 7.2, your favorite frequency, it's giving you a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. Because you're going to be using LMR 400 and only 75 feet of it, which has got very little loss at 40 meters, if you've got a reasonable antenna tuner, you're going to get 95% of the performance once you adjust that antenna tuner to match it to your transmitter, even though the antenna itself has a weird and high standing wave ratio. So it's not a showstopper. It's only an annoyance. Let me pass it back to you to see if that made some sense, John.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I'm going to pass it back to you, John. Drag your feet a little bit just in case someone else wants to give us their wisdom on this one. KC2 WGB with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Somewhat a similar antenna.
Okay, yeah. What is your similar antenna experience, Mel? Go ahead.
Okay, this is one of the types that, we discussed. Basically, it's got that matching network. Well, basically, that's what you sent me through the email, one of those designs where everything is encapsulated on the bottom of the matching section. The antenna, they recommend that you put it on up to a 10-foot mast. So I did provide that mast up on the 15 feet above ground, And then I made some observations about how it performed, moving it up and down the mast and everything, and again, comparing it to the dipoles that go over.
So I think you're saying when you moved it up and down, you did see a change in performance. Run that one by again, Mel, go ahead.